You are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, episode 80. It's a podcast about role-playing games and the people who play them. My name is Eran Avira.
And my name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello!
And today we'll talk about dice, but not just how we usually use them. Most systems just have dice, and then you roll some dice and you add some stuff, or maybe it's a dice pool. Sure. But there are other ways to use dice. Mechanical ways to use dice.
Tell me more.
Some of them are generic and can be used in any system, or at least in most systems. And to begin, we'll start with a few explanations of some more well-known systems, and we'll explain a bit of how they work and why, and then we'll go into uncharted territory.
And what better way to start than exploding dice? What exploding dice mean, in case you have not come across this term, if you roll the highest possible value of a given die, you re-roll it and add the new result to the previous one. So, if I'm rolling a d6 and I get a 6, I immediately roll another d6 and add that number to the previous 6. And if I roll another 6 and another 6 and another 6, I can stack them up and get to insane numbers. I once played Savage Worlds and I got a result of 30-something on a 1d8 roll, which is amazing!
This is also called open-ended, and open-ended can be both on the upper end and both at the bottom end. You can technically roll a 1 and then roll again and remove that number from the result, and again with each one going forward. And Rollmaster uses that sort of a horrible, horrible system. But we are not here to say you should use exploding dice in your mechanics, because you already are using some sort of system. And, for example, in D20, in D&D, exploding dice just won't work. Rolling a d20 and getting a 20 is already fun and excellent, and you know, you get a spectacular result in most cases. Just adding another d20 and adding it probably won't do much, not to say nothing of the chances of it happening only once out of every 20 rolls. So what are we talking about? We want to explain that there's a certain experience, certain effect that arises out of exploding dice that is very different from the feeling of getting a 20 on a d20. There are two different things. They are exciting, but once I roll a d20 and I get 20, I'm excited once. When I roll an exploding die, I never know what is going to happen. With every roll, there is a chance that it will explode and then explode again, and then maybe, I don't know, maybe I am able to beat the dragon with the dagger. With exploding dice, I'm on an emotional roller coaster, because I can, with every attack, perhaps get the baddie down with a single roll, but they can do the same, because it could be that a tiny little goblin rolls amazingly well and I'm falling flat on the ground. Everything is exciting and somewhat, therefore, of course, unpredictable. It's not that if I can't calculate exactly the chances of everything happening, but it's way more complicated and less likely for me to care about the exact numbers than with a d20, where I know exactly how many times I need to roll in order to get a 20. One in every 20, obviously.
Obviously.
So with that out of the way, let's continue and talk about something else. The wild die. Savage Worlds is a system that we both really like, and it uses exploding dice, but it also uses something else entirely called a wild die. And that is a sort of mechanics that can potentially be used in other systems. But first, again, we need to explain not only how it works, but what it does. What is the experience that is then created around the table? So first of all, a wild die is simply a d6 that you roll along with any other roll that you make. Imagine that whenever you roll a d20, you also roll another d20. And it's enough for one of them to succeed. That is, you either succeed because of your skill or because of the wild die, which doesn't represent anything about your character. It does not arise out of your character's abilities. It's there because you are a heroic person in this world, and so there are better chances for you to succeed. In Savage World, you roll various dice. You roll a d4, a d6, d8, whatever. The die that you roll is your ability, because the target number is always 4. So if you roll a bigger die, the chances to succeed are better. But the wild die is always a d6. And that means two things. First of all, generally speaking, even without your skill, there's 50% chance that you succeed on anything that you do. Because if you only try to get a 4, and you always roll at least this d6, you'll get 4 and above in 50% chances. That's just how it works. And the second thing it means that even if you don't know what you're doing, even if you have a d4, which is like the lowest strength that you can have in a skill, you still might do way better than any regular person in the world, someone who doesn't have a wild die, simply because you have the wild die, which again, only means that you are the hero of the story. It doesn't mean anything else about you.
I had a lot of hard time trying to understand that because it didn't make sense for me when I started playing Savage World to just have an extra die, which has nothing to do with your character.
And that you don't even add to the first one. It's not that you roll two dice and you look at them separately. That is weird.
But it grew on me. It grew on me because it's an easy, simple way of saying, hey, you're the protagonist. Awesome things happen around you because you're awesome.
Yes. And I think it works pretty well in doing so. You feel as if you were generally good at succeeding. You bring yourself to dare to try out more things. Even if you are bad at something, you still have a chance of succeeding. So the story will roll forward. Savage Worlds is a system in which continuing on, having action, is the important thing. So just roll for it. Maybe you'll make it. And it even explodes, so, you know. There's another interesting, really weird sort of mechanic from the Sentinel Comics role-playing game. Sentinel Comics is not an actual comics. It's based on the Sentinels of the Multiverse board game, card game, actually, which is pretty good. It's a lot of fun. It's a cooperative card game where several people, each of them has their own deck with its own theme of a specific superhero, uses that deck and specific mechanics for that hero to try and fight the baddie, who is played by the game. So we are all working together. In Sentinel Comics, the role-playing game, they took the same concept and transferred it into a semi-role-playing game. I'm not sure I would actually call it a role-playing game. The book itself is not out yet, but you can buy the starter set, and I would highly recommend it. First of all, because it's an amazingly well-done starter set, with lots of mechanics and lots of cool adventures and many interesting heroes you can play. But second of all, because of this strange, interesting mechanic. Whenever you try to do something in Sentinel Comics, you roll 3 dice. One is taken from your power set, one is taken from, if I remember correctly, your personality, and one is taken, if I remember correctly, from your tools. The better the ability, the better the die. So if you have like very uninteresting powers or powers that has nothing to do with the current situations, you will roll a d4. But if you are trying to lift a car and you are very strong, you will probably roll a d12 or something like that. And you roll all 3 dice, but then you are looking at which die got the highest result, which guy got the lowest result, and which one got the medium result. Because these numbers are what matter. For example, you might say, I'm using a freeze ray, and freeze ray deals mid damage. That is, the medium die out of these 3, that's the number of damage I will deal. Or I will be dealing max damage if I spend a point. And then I am able to choose the max damage if I spend a point of heroic or whatever. This is weird. This is an unusual way to look at your dice. You don't add anything, you don't subtract anything. You roll 3 different dice, and then compare them to each other. So you want to roll bigger dice because your minimum and your maximum and your mid die will all be higher. The numbers you'll get are statistically higher than if you roll lower dice. The next thing I want to talk about is the escalation die, which is a concept taken from 13th Age and can definitely be used in many, many other systems. The escalation die is a d6 that is placed at the middle of the table after the first round of combat. It's placed with the 1 showing. That 1 is then added to all of the player characters' attacks and damage rolls. So, generally speaking, you are a bit better than you were the first round of combat. By the end of the second round, the die is then moved, so the 2 is facing. And now everyone adds their 2, going on, etc., etc., till you get to 6. And that means 2 things. First of all, generally speaking, as the fight goes longer, there are better chances that it will grow shorter because we have better chances of hitting and we will deal more damage. So the fight will end in a relatively short time compared to if we didn't have the escalation die, simply because the enemies will go down faster.
I know a variant of this. When this idea was taken to D&D 3rd edition and Pathfinder, in order to speed up combat, you add the escalation die to everyone, PCs and NPCs alike. And the idea is that the longer a fight goes on, everyone becomes more tired, there's a bigger chance of someone slipping up, so people get hurt a lot more and for a greater extent of damage.
In 30th Age, especially dangerous monsters can benefit from the escalation die as well, like boss monsters and stuff like that, which makes fights with them, of course, more dangerous.
It really allows you as a player to think, okay, this is a fight, we have to finish this quickly,
yes.
Otherwise people are going to get hurt more and more. It also gives you that sensation of not just urgency, but also...
escalation, I think. I think it's a good word. The energy is spiking. Everything is heightened with every passing round.
It's a very good thing to take to your game if you want things to suddenly become very dangerous.
The second cool thing about escalation die is that it's a combat tracker. That is, it shows which round we're currently in. That means, for example, that some classes can have powers that only activate on escalation 2 and above. It's a power that you can't use on the first round of combat. You can only use it on the third round of combat, because now escalation is at 2. You can have the same thing for monsters. And that allows for some sort of pacing. Like, for example, maybe it's awesome to have Meteor Shower not as the first thing that happens in combat, but only as sort of the later thing that happens in combat, because we want to see combats in which sudden spikes of fire from the sky takes a few turns until they arrive, until they happen, because that's awesome. That's more interesting than just, fireball, you're all dead, let's continue. There are also abilities that only activate on even numbers of escalation, so only on 2, 4, and 6. Only on these turns, and I remind you that once you get to 6, you remain at 6. So from that point forward, only then you can use these powers. Again, monsters or player characters alike. That's interesting. The next sort of die mechanic is sort of the opposite of escalation. It's called depletion. And I'm not sure where I saw it first, but now it's used by several systems of the OSR movement, that is, the old school revival or renaissance movement. These are games that try to put a lot of emphasis on the player making choices and surviving in a dangerous sort of situation, more so than on a character or a specific story or a type of storytelling, etc. And depletion dice are a simple way of keeping track of your, for example, torches. How many torches I have. Instead of actually keeping track of how many torches I still have, I can use the depletion system, and then I still keep track of my ability to use torches without needing to resort to literally keeping track of how much time has passed and doing these little X's on my character sheet to mark all of the torches that I'm missing. When you buy a pack of torches, you gain a D8 depletion die. Then, whenever you finish, let's say, a bit of exploration, which is a unit of time that is measurable within the game somehow, however it is that you find usable and useful for you, like, let's say, 8 hours, or let's say, after 3 encounters, it doesn't matter. Once the bit has ended, you will roll the depletion die, and if you get a 2 or less, that is 2 or 1, then you reduce the D8 to a D6. And then you do it again next time. And again, if you got a 2 or 1, you reduce it to a D4. And now if you got a 2 or 1, then you are out of torches. So you know you have at least 3 more bouts of torches, because even if you get a 2 or 1, your D8 only becomes a D6, and then will become a D4, and then you're out. But you're never sure exactly how longer than that you have, because it depends on the die. And the less you have, the higher the chances that you will be able to keep the torches going. Once you have a D6, the chances are pretty good for you to go down to the D4. And once you have a D4, it's 50% that you will go out of torches the next time you end a bit.
it's interesting how different players and different people like to keep track of things in a very different way. If you would ask me, Uri, how many torches do you have? I'm going to look at my character sheet and I'm going to say 14, each one burning roughly for an hour. That's 140 hours of light. This is the best way for me because it makes sense to me. And of course, you put extra and extra layers of obfuscation on it, so it would be more, I don't even have a word for that.
Mysterious and yes, random? And random. More yes, mysterious? Yes. That is exactly this. I think that the depletion system adds an air of mystery to your resources. It means that you will run out of resources, but you are unsure exactly how and when.
Yeah, I can see the appeal. As in many of the things we're mentioning here, I think it's an excellent way to obfuscate bookkeeping. You simply have a list of equipment. At the end of the adventure, you roll a depletion die to see if it's used up or not. You don't need to keep track during the adventure, which is something I really like. I dislike bookkeeping except for spells because I feel it's part of the magic.
I agree. Of course, depletion systems can be used for things like spells. Like whenever you cast Magic Missile, you roll its depletion die. And when it's out, eventually you're out. You no longer have the ability to cast Magic Missile. Maybe you can even say something like, the die that I use for Magic Missile is the depletion die. So the damage I deal at first is D8, but then eventually it will become a D6 and a D4, dwindling along the way until I can no longer cast it.
Man, that sucks. You use all your power to cast Magic Missile, and you like do a nothing damage, and everyone looks at you, what's up, dude? And you're like, well, my power is waning.
Yes.
I can no longer.
Yes. That's a glad
yeah, death. Yeah, it's actually it's kind of awesome.
We'll continue to hero points. You can use dice, of course, to track stuff. Like with the escalation die, you put it on a specific face, and then you know I still have 5 points of whatever. But that's, I mean, cool. But you can also use the die itself as a sort of a counter. Like, for example, in my current Pathfinder 2 campaign, we use hero points, which is something that Pathfinder 2 does. Hero point, generally speaking, simply allows you to reroll the d20 if you don't like the result. And then you spend the point so you can do that. However, I don't just give my players counters. I give them D6s. And this serves two things. First of all, these D6s, which are of a different color than their own, mark how many hero points they have. But second of all, whenever they roll the D20 the second time, when they actually use the point, they also roll the D6 and add it to the result, thereby making the spent of the hero point into an interesting choice, where the chances of you succeeding are actually higher, because simply rerolling will not actually give you specifically a better result. It might even be worse result than your first roll. With this D6, things are a bit more interesting, and I get 2 effects with one die.
I do something similar in D&D 5 with my Bardic Inspiration. For those who do not know, Bardic Inspiration allow you to let someone else add 1d6 for their roll, but you have to do that in advance. You give someone inspiration, and then sometime in the next few minutes, they can add 1d6 to their roll. So I got myself a bunch of specialty d6s that I just hand out to players when I give them Bardic Inspiration, so they will be able to roll that later on whenever they feel like it, like they need that inspiration.
It gives them a physical reminder that they have this ability.
Yeah, because one of the main downside of many, many buffs and abilities that allowed you to give other people the ability to add something to their roll is that you forget about
them. Yes.
It's like coupons. You spend a lot of money on that and then you never use that.
Most things should have some sort of physical representation around the table if they have some sort of effect on the mechanics. And we continue to my last example, which is probably the weirdest. There's a game called Icarus. It's a game about the rise and fall of great civilizations. And it uses an interesting mechanic called the Monument. Icarus comes with several D6s, but these D6s are not for you to roll. They have nothing on them except for a marking of like a monument sort of icon. You place these dice one on top of the other. As you create the monument in game, each player places a die on top of the currently existing monument. Until, of course, it falls down. When the tower collapses, because it will eventually happen, and the dice in Icarus are actually with rounded edges, so to make sure that it happens eventually. When it happens, then something very important in the story happens. This is might resemble Dread, for those of you who know the game. It's a game based around a Jenga tower, in which whenever you do something risky, you take a brick out of the Jenga tower, and eventually it will collapse. And then someone dies in Dread. With this mechanic of building up until it collapses, no one has to die. It can represent all sorts of things. Again, it might be used to track something happening in the party, like, for example, maybe tensions. If there are tensions in the party, maybe you start building a dice tower. And each of you, when they are feeling as if they are resentful or they were slighted, they add a d6 to the tower, until eventually it will collapse, and that will signify to us that we are angry at each other and there is some sort of emotional tempest going around and we will all be bitter and angry at each other, etc., etc., etc.
We should strive to remember that there's a ton of specialty dice out there who is meant to make our lives more random. There's crit die, which I've used in several games. It's simply a die with all sorts of area of the body where you specifically hit on a crit. There's the sex position die, which come in handy in some types of games. There's alignment die, whenever you need a new NPC and you can't make up your mind how it would act. There's something which I love, which is a chores die. It is 2d6s with basically totally regular house chores on them. I got it as a gift. The idea was that if you and your spouse need to do any of the chores, you roll the dice and see who does what. I have it here with me. I'm going to read out loud some of this. It's wash the dishes, cook, do nothing, wash clothes, sweep the grounds, or buy vegetables. Now, I actually use this for NPCs because one of the things I keep forgetting about NPCs that they have their own lives. So when there's a new NPC that the players are meeting for the first time, I usually roll one of these dice to see what that NPC is currently doing. And I find that it makes them amazingly more memorable. Mm. It's not just the Grand Lord Duchess of Vampirism who is currently making dinner. It is the Honor Captain of the Guard, Sir Vegetarian, who is buying vegetables at the moment. It's the little things. You have to remember, it doesn't matter if you're the grand evil mage of Dark Ascension. Sometimes you need to clean your desk or to wash some carrots. It's a part of life.
I think that the moment when you encounter an NPC, that specific point in time where you see them doing something is of course important for your first impressions of them, but also it's great to show something about the world. Like if you show that even a war chief needs to clean their own shoes and you meet them while they are doing this very mundane sort of thing, you are saying something about not only the war chief but also probably the world around them. Like it's a sort of place where you need to clean your own shoes for whatever reason. But maybe this is for another episode. Let's sum this up, Uri. What more do we have to say, finally, about using dice in interestingly mechanical ways?
I think the most important thing to remember is that many of us think about dice rolls as a simple roll of the dice with possible modifiers add to it. And there are many other things that you can do with dice. I hope that the examples we just gave would open up people to the idea that you can do so much more with dice and maybe inspire you to take some of these mechanics and maybe add them to your games in order to spice things up.
I think that the biggest take for me from this episode and episodes like it is, of course, that mechanics influence the experience. They shape the experience of what is actually happening around the table. And like we said with, for example, the depletion die, well, there's two very different ways to look at how resources go away. Both of them will create different effects on how we feel is happening to us, on the sort of fictional world we are in. And that is simply because of the way that we use some randomizers like dice. And that's amazing, and we should always be aware of that. So when we, as GMs or players, aim to create some sort of specific experience, whether it's for one session or as a part of a campaign, or for our own game that we create, we really should ask ourselves, how can we create a mechanic, of course not necessarily with dice, but in this episode we talked only about them, that will evoke that specific thing? What rules will make me feel X.
Yeah, like we always say, everything that happens around the table is a tool that influences our game. Either use it wisely or things are going to happen and you won't understand why.
Very true. And now it's time to take the load off.
This world is carried on the shoulders of the war.
In which we talk about role-playing games in our own personal lives. Ooh-wee.
Well, I have nothing to say. I've been so busy in the last week doing improv stuff and working on my adventure, and we already talked about my adventure last week, but hopefully in a week or two you could all go and see my adventure somewhere
online. It will be a PDF that you can buy. I want to talk about a different PDF that you don't need to buy. You can download it. Created by Aviv Manoah, our technical dwarf. It's called Aces and Mechs, and it's based on Lasers and Feelings by John Harper. Lasers and Feelings is a one-page role-playing game, generally speaking meant for a single session, in which you play sort of a Starfleet, sort of Star Trek-y sort of thing, and everything is created on the spot, including the story that you're going to play, the adventure, everything, villains, and your own characters, and you only roll several d6s, and you only have one attribute, and it's a number, and whenever you roll under or above the number, that's what you're looking for, because above is lasers, and below is feelings. And that's basically it. And Aces and Mechs is the same with mechs. Aviv really, really likes giant robots and people in them.
Don't we all?
Exactly. So he created Aces and Mechs as part of his greater scheme of creating his own mech game. Aces and Mechs, single page, available as a PDF online. You can see it on our website. You can look for it wherever good PDFs are available. And of course, there will be links in the show notes. Go and check it out. I do believe this is everything. So if you want to talk to us about something, you can do so on Facebook, you can do so on Twitter, and you can do so in show@dwarfcast.net. And if you think that this sort of thing, let's say a podcast, let's say about role-playing games, let's say ours, would interest someone else that you know, please send them a link of your favorite episode and say, this is useful and I enjoyed this. Listen to it, please. And they will say, sure. Probably, I don't know. Maybe they don't like podcasts. That's unfortunate. But some people just don't like podcasts. And with that,
later on!
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo. And you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.